from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. While Saudi Arabia's continuing war on Yemen claims an increasing number of civilian casualties across the impoverished nation, a new report said that the Saudi-led forces have been using U.S.-supplied cluster bombs, which are banned by most of the world. Nevertheless, the Pentagon is defending its transfer of the weapons to Riyadh. Press TV's Sheena Sharani has more.
The Saudi war on Yemen began on March the 26th and has so far claimed thousands of lives, mostly civilians. The airstrikes and shelling show no sign of abating as Riyadh is using US and European silence on the aggression. Riyadh began the war in a bid to stem the advances of Ansar Allah fighters. The fighters have been battling Al-Qaeda militants and remnants of the regime of fugitive former president Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. Hadi, who is an ally of Riyadh, has fled to the kingdom and is backing the aggression against Yemen. Civilian populated areas and infrastructure in Yemen have been heavily bombarded since the war began. Human rights groups have repeatedly expressed alarm about the civilians suffering on the ground and the dire humanitarian crisis. In a damning report on Sunday, Human Rights Watch revealed another dimension of Saudi Arabia's deadly war, the use of weapons banned by much of the world. The rights group said the Saudi-led coalition is using US-supplied cluster munitions in its airstrikes.
Credible evidence indicates that the Saudi-led coalition used banned cluster munitions supplied by the United States in airstrikes against Houthi forces in Yemen. Cluster munitions pose long-term dangers to civilians and are prohibited by a 2008 treaty adopted by 116 countries, though not Saudi Arabia, Yemen, or the United States.
The group published images showing the remnants of cluster bombs manufactured by Textron Systems Corporation in the US. They were supplied to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in recent years. According to HRW, targets in Yemen include those close to villages, highlighting a threat from undetonated submunitions to civilians. The United States has reacted to the report. It did not criticize its staunch ally Saudi Arabia or accept blame for what's happening in Yemen. Instead, it's defiantly defended its supplies of banned cluster bombs. A Pentagon official claimed the recipients of U.S. cluster munitions commit that the weapons will only be used against, quote, clearly defined military targets. The war on Yemen has been condemned by some countries, including Russia and Iran. But Saudi Arabia has signaled its willingness to continue its air campaign. Yemen is among the least developed countries in the world. Civilians who have suffered the brunt of the war are waiting impatiently for an end to the violence.
The lack of security for aid workers and fuel shortages are hindering the delivery of aid to conflict-affected communities in Yemen. That, according to the United Nations. The fighting between Saudi forces and Yemeni defenders has left some 12 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, Catherine Hasselberg reports.
A recent escalation of the conflict in Yemen has aggravated an already large-scale humanitarian crisis. In the port city of Aden, local sources have reported continued widespread violence. A two-hour truce proposed by one rebel group has also reportedly not been observed. Stéphane Ducharic is the UN spokesperson.
The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports that insecurity and lack of fuel have limited access to and delivery of services. Partners report difficulty in providing medical services as a result of the current security situation and continued airstrikes targeting Harad, Sada, and Sana.
Meanwhile, the UN's humanitarian coordinator for Yemen has strongly urged forces to stop targeting Sana'a Airport. He described the airport as an important lifeline for humanitarian support. Catherine Hasselberg, United Nations.
An explosion at the Chernobyl nuclear plant 29 years ago released a massive radiation cloud that affected half of Europe, and the fallout may be felt by generations to come, with land remaining contaminated for centuries. RT's Paula Slyer visited the city of Slavutich, built for the nuclear plant's staff, evacuated after the tragedy in the 1980s.
This is Valery Hedimchuk. He died at the reactor and he wasn't found.
One by one, Anatoly shows me the names and photographs of people who died trying to extinguish the flames of Chernobyl almost 29 years ago to this day. He knew them. They were his colleagues and friends.
After all these years, you think you can get used to it, but the mind can't, because dealing with this accident takes a lot of physical and psychological effort.
Anatoly lives in Slavutich, a city built shortly after the Chernobyl disaster, to provide homes for those who had worked at the plant. Many people here have radiation-related illnesses. Evgeny suffers from high blood pressure and breathing problems. Like many here, Evgeny works at the plant. He started a year after the disaster as an engineer inside the exclusion zone. But as risky as his job is, he has little faith his government, in times of emergency, will protect him.
If something like Chernobyl accident happens today, the government of Ukraine won't be able to deal with it. The amount of people and the equipment that was brought in to stop the disaster in 1986, Ukraine doesn't have this. It won't be just Ukraine's problem, but a worldwide problem.
Kyiv has been trying to put a lid on things, much like the Soviet Union did back in 1986, and insists levels of radiation have not increased. But not everyone is buying the story.
Ecologists say it is still too soon to know the impact this fire will have, but the fear is that it has spread radiation beyond the exclusion zone, the impact of which people living here know all too well.
For those who lived and died in Chernobyl, their stories serve as a warning. Paulus Lea, RT, Slavutich, Ukraine.
The Gaza Strip was the scene of a rally Sunday in support of the political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Israel is holding more than 6,500 Palestinian political prisoners who languish in deplorable conditions with long sentences. Sunday's protest called on the international community and the Red Cross to come to the prisoners' defense. Tel Assur's Noor Harazin was in Gaza and filed this report.
Muhjat al-Quds Palestinian Prisoners Institution held an event in central Gaza City on Sunday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli prisons. Dozens of protesters from several Palestinian factions joined the rally that began at the headquarters of the Red Cross and ended in Adabid Square, where members from the institution expressed their solidarity with the exiled prisoners, prisoners on hunger strike, and a further estimated 6,500 Palestinian prisoners being held by Israeli occupation forces.
I was sentenced to 4 life sentences, but spent 21 years in prison and then got out, thanks to God and the resistance. I was freed in a swap deal. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from the oppression of the Israeli jailer and the pain from disease. There are more than 6,500 prisoners being held in Israeli jails, including more than 1,500 prisoners who are suffering from different diseases. The prisoners are forgotten and the world doesn't remember them. We should give them more attention. So I ask the Palestinian leadership and government to put the issue of Palestine prisoners among their priorities.
Tel Assur met with Ibrahim Baroud, who is an ex-detainee who was freed 2 years ago in the second part of Shalit's swap deal after he spent 28 years in Israeli jails. Baroud called on the international community and the Red Cross to take action and stop the illegal Israeli prison policies against Palestinian prisoners.
I am here today to stand and show solidarity with the sick prisoners who suffer so much because of negligence and failure to provide proper treatment and also the lack of medical care and medicine. Both the international community and the International Committee of the Red Cross should step up and help the Palestinian prisoners who have been suffering for years.
Many Palestinian prisoners who have been exiled to Gaza also participated in the protest, calling on Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to intervene in the issue and start working on a deal in which they would be able to return to their hometowns in the West Bank. Noor Harazin, Tel Assur TV, Gaza.
The situation facing the people of Gaza was described in one word by a former American president: intolerable. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter says the situation in the Gaza Strip remains intolerable 8 months after a bloody war on the besieged territory. Carter made the remarks in Jerusalem al-Quds as he wrapped up his three-day visit to the occupied territories. He said not one destroyed house in Gaza has been rebuilt, and the Palestinians cannot live with the respect and dignity they deserve. Over 2,200 Palestinians were killed in the 50-day Israeli war in the besieged territory. Carter also criticized the Israeli prime minister. He said that as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is in charge, there will be no two-state solution and therefore no Palestinian state. Israel Ahmad Alal is a journalist and activist who joins us from the Gaza Strip. So Israel Ahmad Alal, looking at what the ex-U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said about Israel, in particular Benjamin Netanyahu, are we to look at Gaza Strip to solely depend on how Netanyahu wants to deal with it? This should be a matter for the whole world to actually heed to and pay attention to. Do you think there's enough movement made on behalf of the residents and Palestinians in Gaza to try to relieve them of this, I think it's 6 or 7 years now that they're under the siege?
Yes, well, actually, I think it's not enough movement to what's happening in real, especially in Gaza Strip. We are talking about three wars, and it's all about Hamas movement, actually. Jimmy's Carter visit were very important to both Hamas and Fatah conflict, inside situation Palestinian, especially that he was talking about elections and the very important step after reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas is the elections and only the elections. And especially his visit was supposed to be to Gaza Strip. And then we can talk about how much was this visit important or not. Because America right now is planning to do a new strategy in Syria and Iraq and Yemen situation right now. So they need this quiet moment with no wars, no conflict, especially between Hamas and Israel. So they are here right now to talk about the ceasefire. And in the same time, rebuilding, open borders, stop the resistant weapons supporting for Hamas. All of those, it might be happen if Hamas took the conditions of having the port and the airport in the break of this siege. But his visit was not to Gaza. Of course, there is reasons for that. It might be because of the relations between Hamas and the president, Mahmoud Abbas, is broken, and they did not want him to be here in Gaza. And might be even because of the Egyptian relations until this moment between Hamas and the Egyptian government. All of that affected his visit to be happened here in Gaza this the end of this week. If the ceasefire going to be continued, so all of the rebuild and open borders and having the resistance between the hands going to save the peace for Israel, and at the same time America can continue her planning in the Middle East and dealing with the conflicts in Arabian countries and areas, especially in Syria and Iraq. So his visit was only a speech that wasn't it the truth that we needed to hear, actually. It was only talking about elections and reconciliations, about what's important for Hamas and Fatah to have in the coming few days or the future. I think there is things important much than that between Hamas and Israel, particularly talking about long time of period for a long period of the ceasefire that Israel need and America need in the same time, as I mentioned in the beginning, that they need this period of quietness and came down to the area, especially Gaza Strip.
On Monday, the National Guard was in the process of being withdrawn from the streets of Baltimore a day after the city's mayor lifted the nightly curfew. Press TV's Khaniz Fatima has details.
Now, the governor of Maryland says the National Guard has started pulling out of Baltimore after a nightly curfew was lifted. The mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, has thanked people for their patience, adding that she rescinded the order of a curfew. The curfew was imposed after rioting broke out in the city following Freddie Gray's death in police custody. The 25-year-old African-American fell into a coma after being transported in a police van and was taken to a trauma center with spinal injuries. He lost his life a week after the incident. Six Baltimore officers have been charged in the case of Gray's death. The U.S. president has also called for justice to be served in the case. Let's speak to Mustafa Ansari. He's the dean of the American Institute of Human Rights, and he joins us via Skype from Atlanta. Many thanks for joining us here. Now, there's this tense calm over Baltimore as the National Guard has started pulling out. However, will it last?
Well, that's hard to say. The only thing that we can say is that we are vigilant in obtaining our rights to life and our right to have excellent police treatment, just like other Americans.
Right. Speaking of right to life, we do know, as far as Freddie Gray's case is concerned, six police officers have been charged right now. However, do you think there are concerns that these six police officers might be used as scapegoats and being made the exception to the rule instead of actually going down and re-evaluating police community relations?
Oh, absolutely. Six police are just the tip of the iceberg. We're talking about all of the police departments. That's every one of them across the nation are operating under customary racism. And and when you're operating like this, this means that you are treating the people like you're in a war zone. And we have been excessively punished all over the nation. So what we're doing is we're gathering up those thousands of cases. It's cost quite a bit, maybe a couple of $1 million to do that, to be able to bundle all these cases up across the nation, thousands of them, and take them as a bundle into an unbiased court, which is a United Nations court, and to talk about our right to life, the remedy, which is community policing and self-determination in our own areas to get the foreign police troops out of our neighborhoods. So we're just very, very in the first phases of this.
Well, I find it interesting that you've spoken of taking these cases to an international arena like the UN. Why not U.S. courts?
Oh, U.S. courts are part of the problem. There's four levels of problems, and it deals with the police are the least important of those. The first layer of problem are the judges. The judges have perennially looked away when there are cases of excessive police force. They are the ones who enable the police to do what they do. The district attorney's office, those are the prosecutors. They look the other way when the police commit crimes against us. And the police associations, these are the union for the police department who supports the best lawyers to be able to go into court and to in any type of police misconduct or police shooting case and be able to mount a very vigorous defense. The police are just part of the criminal justice problem that we have, and it starts with the judges.
Monday marked the 45th anniversary of the killing of four students protesting the expansion of the Vietnam War to Cambodia that had been announced by then President Richard Nixon 4 days earlier, an expansion that, it was later learned, had actually taken place more than a year prior to the announcement. On May 4th, 1970, 67 shots were fired into a crowd of unarmed students who were more than 100 yards away from the assembled National Guard troops. When the barrage was over, four students were left dead. Jeffrey Glenn Miller, age 20, William Knox Schroeder, age 19, Sandra Lee Schuer, age 20, and Allison B. Krause, age 19. Nine additional students suffered serious gunshot wounds, with at least one being left paralyzed for life. Laurel Krause is the sister of Allison Krause, one of the four shot dead that day by the National Guard. She's the co-founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and was in Kent State Monday to mark the somber anniversary. We spoke with her via Skype from Ohio Sunday. May 4th is the 45th anniversary of the massacre at Kent State. On the heels of a protest there and elsewhere around the country in the days following President Nixon's announcement that he was going to start a war in Cambodia that had actually been going on for better than a year. And this was the first of two incidents that resulted in the shooting deaths of students, including your sister, Allison. You're going to Kent State for the anniversary, right?
I'm on my way. I'm going to be driving down later on this afternoon for the 45th commemoration of the Kent State Massacre. And that's occurring on Monday, May 4th, tomorrow. I'm actually going to be going to a vigil tonight. It starts at midnight. First, there's a candlelight march around campus. And then the vigil starts at midnight and it continues for the next 12 hours. And there are people that hold candles on a schedule, mostly half hour through the night and up until 12 noon on the four spots where the four died in Ohio. Right. And Allison, my sister, was one of them.
Right. Jeffrey Miller, Allison Krauss, William Schroeder, and Sandra Lee Schuer, right?
Yes, and nine were wounded. One was in Dean Kaler was in a wheelchair for the rest of his life and still continues to live, thank goodness. And serious wounds, nothing lightweight here.
Right. Yeah.
And then there's the emotional wounds too. You know, it's having the government target us and then betray us and make it our fault. That's very hard to overcome, especially when we were so young.
Yeah, that's actually been a long journey for you from 1970 until just recently getting international acknowledgement of the fact that this was a murder that was committed by the authorities here.
Yeah, that was a really great day, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
You know, and our efforts managed to bring Kent State outside the complete control of the United States. And for that, I give thanks every day for that one. Because the problem with Kent State has been that it's been under the complete control of the U.S. government.
Right.
Since day one.
Right.
And that was the media. It was every report written, every view uttered. They built a gymnasium on part of the shooting site, the controversial area, of course, and they put a visitor center. They built one just a couple years ago for $1.1 million, and it's still the government's story on what happened on May 4th. And those students, they don't say it, but, you know, the inference is that those students were rabble-rousers, and they deserved it.
Yeah, I'm looking at the data on the four people that were killed, first of all, and the closest one to the National Guard, remember these are people that were either 19 or 20 years old, the four of them. The closest one was about a football field's length away, which is pretty much the average for all four, from where the National, you have assembled troops on the one hand and unarmed students on the other, and the Guard shot them from, you know, 100 yards away.
Right, my sister was 343 feet from her shooters.
Yeah.
And she was in the vocal fronts. She was a protester.
Yeah.
You know, and they said that they were under attack from the students and in fear for their lives. There's not one picture to substantiate, not one video, not one view that gives any credence to that excuse.
Yeah. And among the nine wounded, likewise, the closest one was more than 50 feet away.
That's attempted murder.
Yeah.
You know, when you shoot at unarmed students, you know, the closest person shot was 65 feet.
Right. Yeah. Obviously not a threat to a small group of, not even a small, a moderate-sized group of troops.
I just learned that the fellow Joseph Lewis, who was shot twice,
yeah.
He learned about he knows his shooters. It came at the jury trial that was held in 1975 in Cleveland over the Kent State Massacre. They didn't call it that. They called it the shooting.
Right.
you know, because, you know, people didn't die. Four died. But Joseph Lewis was shot twice. And the fellow that shot him said that he saw a sandy haired guy with his middle finger raised. And he shot at that guy. He thought that there might have been a gun in his other hand. There, you know, Joseph Lewis was a student. He comes from, you know, agricultural, out rural Ohio. And he wasn't carrying a gun. He was getting his education on campus, on his campus.
Right.
And then the second guy that shot him admitted that he shot at him when he was wounded. And when he was asked on the trial, you know, why'd you shoot at him? He said, because everyone else was shooting.
Jeez.
Joseph Lewis has joined us in our action related to the United Nations, and we're making an application soon to a special rapporteur. We were told that the special rapporteur for the United Nations with us is extrajudicial, arbitrary, and summary execution special rapporteur. Mm. So, Joe is joining our cause and our campaign as a wounded eyewitness who was shot twice.
Yeah.
You know, it's great to have, you know, people joining our cause, you know, especially someone of that caliber. You know, it makes sense. You know, our cause hasn't been just for Allison. We're actually looking toward the protection of protesters in 2015. I mean, that's what really drives us.
Yeah.
You know, they set the precedent at Kent State and they can get away with it now. And so it's important that we strike this down and let it be known across the land that this was murder and it was government executed. And they're going after protesters now, too. Yeah. I mean, that's what they did to the Ferguson protesters. And they just got, a settlement, actually reparations for being tear gassed. That was wonderful.
Yeah.
And the courts are starting to do a little bit here and there where they're, you know, they are showing protester protection in the courts. But it's got to really happen on the street.
That's right.
To make the difference before they kill people.
Right. That's right. Yeah, the mayor of Baltimore last week when she made, you know, basically said, look, I'm not going to shoot people because they're destroying property. I'm not going to give the order to do that. And she came under heavy fire politically.
That needed to be said. Absolutely. Yeah. That I mean, they've always cared more about the buildings than the people.
That's
I mean,
right.
Or their businesses. I mean,
that's
revenue.
Right.
Oh, my God.
That's right.
Can't lose revenue.
Yeah.
I mean, something's wrong in this equation. We are a society off balance.
What was interesting to me was when that stuff broke, and I went digging around to cover it, I found clips from the riot, quote-unquote, the uprising in Baltimore in 1968, and the then-adjutant general, George Gelson, was faced with a question from reporters, basically saying the same thing, like, why aren't you shooting these people who are looting or, you know, committing arson or whatever? And he said, this guy was appointed by Spiro Agnew, who was governor of Maryland at the time. And not only that, what Agnew did was perceived as being sufficiently harsh, racist even, that's what got Nixon's attention and had him put him on the ticket to counter George Wallace, who was running as an independent candidate. What this guy said was, look, I wish it was as easy for all the people that think I should have my people out there, you know, with orders to shoot to kill, for me as it is for them, because I have to live with the consequences of it. And what do you place the value of a life? On a pair of shoes, a bottle of whiskey, et cetera, et cetera. He said that. And how far things have come.
Bravo.
Yeah, in the wrong direction, unfortunately, in 45 years' time.
Well, cash is still king, you know, and money will always, you know, we're a capitalist society, and that's, there you go.
Yeah,
you know?
Right, that's about it. That's right. So, going forward, what's on the agenda for the Kent State Truth Tribunal?
Well, what's really great is I've been invited to speak tomorrow and stand for my sister Allison. I'm going to be taking the candle from the vigil that ends at 12 noon, and I'll be walking it to the campus, weather permitting, to the commons with three others, and we will then commence the commemoration.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.